Hello and welcome to an Australian Family Physician online podcast. I'm Zara Margolis. In the April 2014 edition of Australian Family Physician, we explore the topic of challenging life stages. Professor Frank Oberclade is the author of the article, Struggling at School, A Practical Approach to the Child Who is Not Coping, which features in this month's journal.
Professor Frank Oberclade, welcome.
Thank you.
So just how widespread is this issue of children struggling to cope with school?
Well, I think it depends on how you define the problem, but we know that it's very, very common. And the sort of estimate that most people use are that it's as high as 20%, one in five school-age children struggle in one aspect or another. They may struggle with academic areas like reading or spelling or maths. They may struggle with problems with concentration and disruptive behaviour and easy distractibility, or they may have difficulties with social relationships. And sometimes it's a combination of all of those three. So it's very common. You know, generally around one in five is the estimate that we use.
And what are some of the reasons for this prominence?
Well, we usually differentiate learning disability from learning difficulties. So children that have an underlying disability, that is a sort of neurological disability, are a minority of those. And if we're going to use the term dyslexia, it usually refers to these children. These are kids that have a normal IQ, that have the potential to learn, but for one reason or another, have difficulty with learning. And these aren't all that common and need sort of detailed assessment, usually with neuropsychology and skilled educational psychologists. Far more common is what we call learning difficulties, and then there are a combination of reasons. They can be either biological or environmental. So some children struggle because they have problems of hearing or vision. They may have a motor weakness, something sort of inbuilt like that. They may have subtle language problems. They may have difficulty with short-term memory, with concentration. And these are kids that look normal, ostensibly function normally. Mostly their physical exam is unremarkable. So they have subtle neurological signs or subtle developmental weaknesses that usually have to be elicited with a what we call a neurodevelopmental examination. So quite a number of children present with those subtle problems of one or more areas of development. Probably more common in an Australian context are those kids that suffer environmental disadvantage. That is, they grow up in disadvantaged environments where, despite parents doing the best they can, these are kids that don't have the advantage of stimulated early learning environments. There may not be books in the home. Perhaps the parents struggled at school themselves, and so they don't really value education or they feel ambivalent about it. Often these are kids that don't go to kindergarten or preschool. So they arrive at school, sometimes already in trouble with what we call delayed school readiness. That is, they're just not ready from a developmental point of view or a social emotional point of view to make the most out of the school experience. And unfortunately, in this country, that's pretty common.
So how do these struggles or difficulties, as you put it, typically present themselves in the sense that they become noticeable enough that either the parent or the teacher or someone involved with the child wants to then take action?
Yeah, well, sometimes the difficulties are noted very, very early in the child's career. Sometimes they'll be noticed in kindergarten. So already there'll be some clues that things aren't going all that well. So we often get parents of four-year-olds, three-year-olds, five-year-olds, even before they've started school, come to GPs or come to paediatricians with concerns. But often school is the first sort of formal structured setting these children are in. And so a skilled professional, that is the teacher, observes these children objectively for the first time. So for a small number of these kids, it's apparent very early on that the kid is different or immature or struggling and the teacher draws attention to that. And sometimes it's the school that says to the parents, look, I think you need to go and have this child checked out. At other times, when the child has more subtle problems, it's towards the end of the first year at school, or sometimes in the second or third year. What we do know is that children at the age of 4 and 5 usually have a range of maturity. So it's not that uncommon for us to see a 4-year-old and have some concerns, see the same child 6 months later, and it's a different child, because maturation is not linear. Development occurs in spurts, and then there's a plateau for a while, et cetera, et cetera. So in prep, unless the child has pretty clear problems, often he or she is given the benefit of the doubt because of that variability in maturation. By the time the child is in grade 1 and grade 2, these things usually declare themselves. So a 6-year-old, 7-year-old, that uneven maturation should have declared itself. And sometimes the child then has clearly established weaknesses in language or learning or attention or social skills. So sometimes it's the parent that notices that the child isn't up to scratch. We see lots of parents that volunteer, go into their child's classroom and do reading and so on, and notice their child is a bit different, or they compare their child with previous children or with peers, their friends' children. Sometimes it's the teacher at a parent-teacher conference who says, look, I'm a bit worried about your child because he or she is interacting well or is behaving badly or is having difficulty concentrating, etc. And then the parents seek an assessment. So it's a combination of all of those. The more severe difficulties tend to be seen earlier. The more subtle ones, grade 1, grade 2, sometimes even a little bit later.
And so given the prominence of this issue, as you mentioned, and the fact that general practitioners are so well placed to play a big role in prevention and early detection of school difficulties, how would you then suggest GPs go about talking to families about these issues?
Well, I think one of the early things that GPs are ideally placed to do is to talk to parents about how to give their child the best start in life, and that is reading to them each day, making sure they have opportunities for socialization like play groups. We hear a lot of debate about childcare, whether it's good or bad, but we often don't see in the media a discussion of the benefits of childcare in the sense that children, young children have the opportunity to socialize, to make sure that parents do send their kids to kindergarten, because the international evidence is pretty clear that one of the very best things that parents can do is to make sure their child has at least 1 year, preferably a couple of years of preschool or kindergarten. So all of those things are important in terms of prevention, encouraging parents to sort of do the right thing by their kids. And then if problems do occur, GPs are in an ideal situation because they often know the family dynamic, to be able to assess to what extent is it possible that some of these difficulties are caused by family dysfunction or difficulty in parenting, etc., etc. And then if a child presents at 5 or 6 or 7 with difficulties, they can do a physical exam, they can rule out any medical problems. They will have a history of seeing the child, so they can see from their records whether the child has had a history of hearing problems or ear infections. And one of the very good things they can do, particularly in children with language delay, is to make sure that deafness is ruled out, to make sure that they refer for a proper hearing test and preferably a vision test as well, because in an area that's often vague and complex, like children's development, ruling out vision and hearing problems is black and white. That's something that we really should rule out in every single child. And then sometimes these children do need a referral to pediatricians or to a psychologist or to an OT, and GPs can use their usual referral networks for that. And then they have a going role in coordination and making sure that children get the services that they require. So the GP role as advocate for the child is very, very important. Sometimes a letter from a medical practitioner like a GP can be very influential in terms of the school getting extra help for the child or getting an early assessment.
So you mentioned some of the practical steps GPs can take when these problems are first identified, and you mentioned giving referrals, but at what stage is a referral appropriate?
Well, it's pretty hard to generalise. I think the default is the earlier the better. That the worst thing about an early referral is the paediatrician or a psychologist or whoever can just reassure the child, the parent, that things are going okay. But for many children, referrals come late. At least in many paediatricians would say they would have liked to see these kids earlier. I think the thing that we struggle with the most are children that we see at the age of 8 or 9 or 10, about whom the parent has had concerns right from prep, and the school has reassured the parents, "Oh, you're just an anxious parent," or "He's immature," or "She'll grow out of it," or "They're not the worst in the class." I think if parents have a concern, I think that's a very legitimate reason for GPs to get involved. And if then GPs can't reassure parents that things are on track, then I think an early referral is called for. What the worst case is where referral is delayed because the parents don't feel assertive enough to make their concerns known, or where the teachers wrongly tell the parents that there's nothing wrong or he's immature, etc. I think that's the worst outcome. So I think most professionals, most paediatricians and psychologists and educators working with children would much rather see a child referred early and quote unquote unnecessarily than to see that referral delayed. The longer we wait, the harder it is to intervene successfully. The more the risk to the child's self-esteem and motivation, the higher the risk of the child starting to exhibit disruptive behaviours. So the consequences of waiting a long time are significant. So I think we'd much rather err on the side of earlier referral than later referral.
Professor Frank Obercraig, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. You're most welcome.
And you can access a full copy of Professor Frank Obercleid's article, Struggling at School, A Practical Approach to the Child Who Is Not Coping, in the April 2014 edition of Australian Family Physician. You can also access the journal online at www.racgp.org.au/AFP.